Peace be with you. Friends, we have some idea in our culture of what makes families well-adjusted, psychologically balanced, healthy, happy. We might speak of good communication, mutual respect, the right balance of authority and obedience, parents that know how to let go of their children appropriately, etc., etc. All these are good pieces of advice when it comes to making a family healthy, happy, balanced. All of it's right and important. But none of it has directly to do with holiness. Our feast day today, the first weekend after Christmas, is the Feast of the Holy Family. It's meant to draw attention to this more elusive factor. What precisely is it that makes a family holy? I mean, even if we say they're good, they're balanced, they're psychologically together, but what is this elusive quality of holiness? Is it reducible to those things, something beyond them, something totally different? Well, I think we have to attend rather carefully to the stories told about Jesus, Joseph, and Mary, this holy family proposed to us by the church, and see what we can discern. Let's look at Joseph first. Joseph stands in a long line of biblical dreamers. His Old Testament namesake, Joseph, from the book of Genesis, he was an interpreter of dreams. Remember, he interpreted the dreams of those around Pharaoh. Daniel, during the time of the Babylonian captivity, also attended very intelligently to dreams. He told the king what his dreams meant. Jacob has a famous dream of angels ascending and descending on a great ladder. Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, falls into a deep slumber and experiences a startling vision of God. Now, people across the cultures, it's not unique to the Bible, people across the cultures have long been impressed by the strange power of dreams, how they can haunt us and communicate meaning to us, even though they seem rather bizarre or illogical on the surface. The biblical authors saw dreams as a privileged means of divine communication. So the psalmist, for example, praises God who, quote, even at night directs my heart. Isn't that fascinating? God directing us during the day while our conscious minds are engaged, but God who directs us even at night, that means directs us through our dreams. Now, here's the point. Joseph didn't follow his own projects, his own plans, but the project and plan of God, revealed to him from above. Look, like everybody else, Joseph must have had his own hopes, his own expectations for his life. But he was willing to set those aside in favor of what God was asking him to do, even when this would cost him. And we see that so clearly in these stories, don't we? That what Joseph is commanded to do is a very dicey, dangerous business. We hear in the story, a few months later, a voice from on high directs Joseph to take the child and his mother to Egypt. Then some years later, that same voice tells him to take his family home to Nazareth. All this time, this dreamer was directed by a higher will. We're getting now our clue of what constitutes holiness. Would you point to Joseph necessarily as a model of the well-balanced person? Well, frankly, I don't know. We don't get any clues from the story about what we would take all that seriously in terms of psychological balance. We just don't know. The Bible directs our attention to his holiness, and it means this attention to a higher will. Now, consider Mary. Like any young woman of that time and place, first century Palestine, she had her hopes, she had her expectations. Whom she would marry, how many children she would have, how she would contribute to her community. But then she receives an even more startling indication of God's will. She receives a visit from an angel, a heavenly messenger who lays out for her this extraordinary plan. Though a virgin, she would give birth to a son, who would be the Son of the Most High. Now, we've heard this proposal so many times, and Mary's role in the life of the church is so well established, that we barely pause at these words. But can you imagine now what it must have been like to have heard them for the first time, and from such a messenger? Mary's life interrupted. Out of the blue comes this absolutely overwhelming, flabbergasting invitation. And she must have understood so little of what the angel said to her. I mean, she signals her surprise. I mean, how is this possible? I do not know man. But she had no idea, even beyond that point, of what it would entail, what it would mean, what it would imply for her life. We hear that Mary treasures these things in her heart. Well, yeah, she meditates on them, seeks to understand them, but she didn't know what it would imply. And yet, she recognizes this as the Word of God, as the desire of God, and she reordered her life accordingly. Listen to the hinge line from this gospel. Behold, I am the maidservant of the Lord. Be it done to me according to thy word. There it is. At that moment, she surrendered her autonomy. She gave up her plans and projects. She gave herself over to a higher power. Joseph is a dreamer who listens to the word of God communicated in these dreams. Mary is someone who converses with the angel, who hears this invitation. Neither Joseph nor Mary understood it fully. Neither one could possibly have seen the contours of what it involved. And yet they surrendered. I've used that line with you many times before. Your life is not about you. Saints are those who get that. And not just intellectually, they get it viscerally. They get it in their bodies. They change their lives according to it. Your life is not about you. That's what Joseph acknowledged. That's what Mary acknowledged. We're getting a clearer sense, aren't we, what it means to be holy. And now, consider Jesus himself. It's our gospel for today. Luke's gospel. And it's one of the earliest glimpses we have of the Lord after his birth. In fact, it's really the only one. The Gospels, Luke and Matthew have the infancy narratives. Then we cut almost immediately to the public life of Jesus. The one glimpse we have of Jesus the child is here in Luke's Gospel. The finding in the temple. Jesus among the doctors. Perhaps this is why artists and poets and thinkers have considered this passage so precious. Jesus had been, we presume, a dutiful child, obeying his parents, following their prompts and directions. But then, just as he's beginning adolescence, how many parents will say when they read the story they recognize this? They know when their kids are trying to find their own way. Just as he's coming to adolescence, he leaves his parents during a trip to the temple. He stays behind among the doctors and the scribes, asking and answering questions, caught up in the ecstasy of understanding the ways of God. You know, to get the sense of the story, go back to the times when you first were caught up in the excitement of studying whatever it is that you love to study, whether it's physics or it's chemistry or it's history or it's philosophy, when your mind is first caught fire and you're just drawn into the beautiful give and take, the rhythm of question and answer. That's where the young Jesus is here among the doctors. When his parents find him, and understandably enough complain, he utters that devastating line, and it must have been devastating to Mary especially. Why were you looking for me? Did you not know I must be in my Father's house? Jesus loved Joseph and Mary. I mean, that's just clear. But his life was not finally about them or their desires. It was about the desire of his Father in heaven. He began from the earliest moments of his conscious life to listen to the Father, to follow his promptings, to do his will, See, we get the first glimpse of it here, don't we? The first glimpse of Jesus having directed his life not to his own plans, not even to the plans of his remarkably holy parents, but directing his life to do the will of God. And so this is what it means to be holy. It's to realize your life is not about you. It means to place yourself dramatically, radically in the hands of God, to be about God's business above all. Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. Again, we don't know much about their lives psychologically. The Bible doesn't tell us. We don't know much about their daily lives. We couldn't really analyze that using our familiar categories. But the Bible tells us that each in a particular way manifested precisely this quality. And that's why they constitute the holy family. Now, here's the challenge to all of us. We must make our families places where the will of God is discerned and heeded. Some people have been privileged to receive extraordinary revelations of the divine will, but for most of us, things are a bit more ordinary. So how do we know? How do we know what it means to turn your life over to God, to say it's not about me, but about God? Let me offer you this hint. Whatever is prompting you to greatest love, to greatest justice, to greatest truth and integrity, to greatest self-gift, that is the voice of God in you. Let me say it again. I think it's a very important spiritual principle. Whatever prompts you in the course of your decisions, the course of the concrete moves that you make, whatever is prompting you to greatest love, greatest justice, greatest truth and integrity, greatest self-offering, that's the voice of God in you. Is it easy? Almost by definition, no. That's why Thomas Merton said, do you want to know the will of God? You're looking at two decisions. Which one is harder? That's probably God's will. Which one is calling for a greater self-gift? That's the will of God. Are you willing to say, that's the center of my life? Then you found holiness. When all the members of a family follow that call together, then they are the holy family. And God bless you.